From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. So it's a peanut ricotta?
It's similar to that, yes. Mm-hmm.
Wow. So you're infusing the milk?
Yes.
So you could also make a peanut ice cream?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I've been talking with writer Lindsay Jane Hard about turning peanut shells into cheese. No kidding. It's one of the recipes in her book titled Cooking with Scraps. On average, an American produces 133 pounds of food waste each year, while 40% of food in this country goes uneaten. In response, the USDA has set a nationwide goal to cut food waste in half by the year 2030. Lindsay Jean Hard suggests doing your part by cooking with things like peels, cores, rinds, and stems. Hi, Lindsay Jean.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great. I have to say that there have been quite a few books out in the last few years about food waste and scraps, but I think what I admire most about yours is that it's really a manual. It's a tool so that as you come upon different situations, you can go to it and try and find a solution.
Yeah, I really hope that people see it as a reference guide. I tried to organize it from A to Z, so it's something that you can turn to when you don't know what to do with a specific ingredient.
What's interesting, too, is you credit so many different people throughout the book with ideas that it seems like for you, adopting new strategies has just become the norm.
Yeah, the whole thing was really a learning process for me. It came out of a column that I had when I was working at food52.com, a food and lifestyle website. And I had a column of the same name, Cooking with Scraps, and I would hunt through the community archives of recipes looking for ones where people were making smart use of underutilized produce parts. And I just learned so much from them in the process that I wanted to share that and, of course, credit the people that I learned from along the way.
So you lived in Japan for a time where you were introduced to the concepts of motenai and harahachibu. Could you explain their meaning and why they resonated for you?
Yeah, so harahachibu is a traditional Okinawan saying, and it's one that listeners are probably familiar with. It's eat until you're 80% full. That's pretty easy when we think about it, but then in practice, that can be a little bit harder.
Deliciousness sometimes gets in the way.
Yes. So I just try and think of it as eating slowly and eating to the point where I'm comfortable and just giving my brain time to catch up with my stomach. And then the other one, motenai, is somewhat similar to the English expression of waste not, want not. But the Japanese expression, for me, somehow manages to capture the gratefulness for what a gift it was in the first place, whether it's food or time or something else entirely. So you're really appreciating what it was.
So I want to start, well, first of all, I should probably say all my life I've kind of been known as a garbage eater. I've always eaten apple cores.
Yeah.
And also, there are several kinds of citrus peels I really love, particularly with some tangerines and some oranges, where I just eat them like apples.
I eat the whole thing, too.
But I want to start with broccoli and cauliflower, because as a restaurateur, if you look at a head of broccoli, if what you're going to do is just cut off those stems and serve the crowns, there is just so much waste.
Yeah, it's a huge amount of waste, which is why I think that chefs are doing a better job of this than the general public, because they recognize that it impacts the bottom line of their restaurant. And we need to realize that it impacts the bottom line of our households, too.
So let's talk about what you can do with broccoli stems and also the parts of cauliflower that people tend to discard, the core stem piece at the bottom,
mm-hmm.
and then the leaves that are attached. I always wish there were more leaves.
I know, I do too, and there are on the plant. We're seeing more broccoli stems come into the market now, so I think we need to continue this push so that we get the whole cauliflower plant coming to the store with the leaves on it too. The broccoli stems, I like to saute them. I like to poach them in olive oil and put them on toast, slice them up for slaw. I mean, they're so versatile.
Leek tops. Here, you know, so many of us shop at the farmers markets. And if you buy leeks in the farmers markets, you get extra super long tops.
Yeah.
What can we do with them?
That's another great example of one of the things that I think we've just been conditioned to get rid of because the recipe tells you to use the white part and cut off and discard the green tops. But there's really no reason to do that. They're perfectly edible. So I like to chop them up finely, sliver them, and use them in pasta. But you could sauté them and add them in with other mixed greens or use them as a topping on pizza. They're delicious.
One of the things I love about what you do with them when you're slivering them lengthwise is you're combining them into a cacio e pepe.
Yeah, so it really just mixes in with the noodles and adds color and flavor and doesn't waste the food.
I think one of the, well, there's a couple really surprising uses in the book, but banana peels.
I think that's probably the most surprising, yes. I like to cook them a little bit to soften them and then blend them into a puree. And I'm using them in the book in a cake. It gives it a really nice, light, bouncy texture. You would have no idea that it's made with banana peels. But you could use it other places in baking, too. Like, if you have a favorite banana bread recipe, you could sub in the banana peel puree instead of the mashed bananas.
At what point in the banana's ripeness are you using the peel in this way?
Ideally with super ripe bananas.
And you have a footnote that's so interesting about a link between something in the peel and latex.
Yeah, if you have a latex allergy, there's something in the banana peel that could trigger a similar reaction. So you should not eat them.
So interesting.
Yeah.
And this is a family recipe of yours.
Yeah, I originally did want to do a banana bread type recipe for the cookbook, but it's hard to find a perfect banana bread. I haven't found mine yet, but I do have this banana cake that I make every year for my birthday. That was my grandmother's recipe, and so I knew that was perfection, and so it was a good place to start.
Okay, so I understand using pineapple cores in things, because that's another thing where I always think of, why do we cut them out? It's just, I don't understand.
Unless I like to eat them.
Unless you don't have teeth, yeah. And also, I love to pickle them.
I haven't tried pickling them. That's a great idea.
They have the perfect texture for a snappy pickle.
Yeah.
But melon rinds, I have never ventured that far.
Well, I've had a lot of pickled melon rinds before, but I was trying to come up with something else different to do with it. The watermelon granita is one of my favorite recipes in the book. It's just so refreshing, and granitas are so easy.
Describe what part of the rind you're using.
So you're not using the dark green part of the watermelon peel. You're using the white part. And then if you have some of the extra fruit, the actual flesh, that's fine too, and it'll give it a little color.
So you actually make the granita just using the rind?
Yeah, when I had people testing the recipes, that mine was a clearish green because I stuck to just purely the white. But then I had testers who used slight bits of the fruit. So some were pink, some were yellow. Like, it's fun to see the different color ranges that you can get with it.
One of the sections of the book that shows up throughout is a section on cleaning out the crisper.
Yes.
That's the saddest day. Untapped potential that we've let slip through our fingers.
Yeah, so we're trying to help avoid that happening. So when you have all of those odds and ends, these are the recipes that can help you put them to good use, whether it's a quick pickle or something like a frittata or a strata. So it's not necessarily using the underutilized produce parts in this case, though it could be. This is more of helping you with those other odds and ends that are hanging out in the fridge.
Oh, I have to ask you about the peanut shells, because peanut shells are something that I always think, why isn't there peanut shell mulch, you know, in the garden store? What are they doing with those peanut shells industrially?
Yeah. That's true. That one came out of chatting over drinks with friends, and we were trying to come up with the hardest to use scraps. Someone said coffee grounds, and then I came up with a couple recipes for that, and then someone said peanut shells, and I was like, that's such an interesting one. And it was fun to play around with because they do impart a lot of peanut flavor. I'm using them to make a simple pot cheese like ricotta, and it's incredibly salty.
That's so interesting. And then you just glossed over something. You said you use coffee grounds.
Yes. That, I think, is another surprising one for folks. They might not think those are edible, but I make a French press pot every morning. So I have a lot of coffee grounds, and I do have a garden, so they get put to good use there. But still, that's a lot of coffee grounds to go through. So in the cookbook, I'm using them in a nut butter. So they add texture and they add coffee flavor to that nut butter. But I also have another recipe on Food 52 for them that I love. It's a French silk pie. And the coffee grounds get used two ways. They get used in a crust along with chocolate cookies.
So you're taking like the Oreo wafers.
Yes.
Which are becoming harder and harder to find. Mm-hmm. And you're whizzing those up with?
Used coffee grounds.
Wow.
Yep.
That's a great idea.
So that's making your crust and then chocolate French silk filling. And then the coffee grounds are also used to infuse cream to make a whipped cream topping that has that same coffee flavor in it.
I love this because when we think of the word frugal or frugality, it seems punitive.
Yeah, and as does the word scraps. I think we just need an entire rebranding here to make everyone realize how great these things are.
Well, thank you so much, Lindsay Jean. It's a wonderful manual and really a font of ideas.
Thank you so much.
That's writer Lindsay Jean Hard. We've been talking about cooking with scraps, the title of her new book. You may have heard that Congress passed a massive farm bill last month, right before the shutdown. But what's in it? After the break, reporter Leah Douglas is here to explain. Stick around.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. About a year ago, we started following the process of passing the giant omnibus bill known as the Farm Bill.
The Farm Bill often becomes sort of a political football because of how much money in the bill is allocated towards nutrition programs and particularly towards aid programs like SNAP.
Our guide to understanding this crucial piece of legislation has been food and agriculture reporter Leah Douglas. Leah's back to fill us in on the final bill that the president signed into law on December 20th. Hi, Leah.
Hi, Evan. Thanks so much for having me.
Can you remind us of the importance of the Farm Bill?
So the Farm Bill is a crucial piece of agriculture legislation that, among other things, funds essential agriculture programs. It also funds an enormous percentage of our nutrition programs, including school lunch programs and the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And the Farm Bill is passed every 5 years or so, can be a little longer depending on politicking around the bill.
And how much is in that bill money-wise?
So this year's Farm Bill was about $867 billion.
Okay, let's just sit with that for a minute. That's like coming upwards to $1 trillion. So it's an important piece of legislation.
Exactly.
What was the final vote tally for passage this time around?
So in the House, there was a pretty decisive margin, 386-47 in favor of the bill. And in the Senate, also pretty decisive, 87-13.
There's so much in there, but what were some of the big takeaways that food activists were most concerned about?
So the big battle this time around on the Farm Bill, as it often is, was around politics pertaining to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which is commonly called the food stamps program. And so in this version of the bill, House Republicans were really trying to strip SNAP benefits and reduce the number of people who are receiving SNAP benefits by expanding work requirements for those who are receiving the benefits, which, to be clear, there are already work requirements for people who participate in the SNAP program. So the original legislation proposed by the House sought to expand those work requirements and would have reduced the number of people eligible for food stamps significantly. That was what sort of dragged the process on. Ultimately, that was not included in the final bill, which was seen as a huge victory by anti-hunger advocates and other food activist groups. However, the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, is now working with President Trump to propose their own rulemaking that does a very similar thing regarding the work requirements of the food stamp program that's currently accepting public comment and is under review.
What's really interesting to me about this battle is typically the Farm Bill was seen as this bifurcated piece of legislation where you had on one hand all the agriculture portion, which is rural, and then you had the nutrition part, which was formerly seen as being primarily a way for urban constituents to benefit from the, quote, Farm Bill. But given the erosion of employment in the rural areas these days, it seems like SNAP is now really countrywide and there shouldn't be that sort of bifurcated support.
Sure. And that's definitely something that a lot of anti-hunger advocates are really trying to drill home for folks who are consuming news about the Farm Bill, is that every state has people who receive SNAP. It's very common. Millions of people are in some way associated with nutrition programs that are funded by the Farm Bill. Even if they're not aid programs like WIC or SNAP, they might be a school breakfast program or a school lunch program that is in some way receiving federal benefits. So there has been a strong push to sort of destigmatize the Farm Bill as having one side for rural and one side for urban populations, and that sort of plays out in the politicking in Congress, but rather to see it as a bill that truly does affect every state and affects people in all different types of living environments.
Aside from SNAP, there was this other fight that was all about the way that property is handed over from generation to generation. Can you talk a bit about this process for heirs, property owners, to continue to participate in USDA loans and programs?
Sure. So this was a big sort of landmark provision of this Farm Bill that a lot of people might not have necessarily heard about. And it has to do with what type of process landowners have to go through in order to participate in USDA loan programs or other types of support. And so typically, in order to receive support from USDA, you have to go through a process to get a farm number, quote unquote, which is relatively straightforward. If you have a clear title to your land, you just sign up for it and then you can proceed. But for a large percentage of particularly low-income landowners, if their land was inherited without a clear title, it can be difficult to ascertain who is the explicit or sole owner of the property or which select group of heirs in a family owns a property. And so that's considered not a clear enough title for USDA to assign a farm number and then work with that family or group of heirs. And that's been a huge hurdle for low-income communities, particularly in the Southeast. It's affected African-American farmers who have lived on the same piece of land for generations, maybe, but have inherited the land and never had a clear will or other document describing whose land it is. And it's prevented a lot of families from receiving supports and loans that many farmers take for granted and that really sustain a lot of conventional agriculture. And so this Farm Bill reduces the barriers in a sort of technical way for those families to work with USDA to ease this process and to eventually get a farm number and therefore be able to participate in the same loan programs and supports that other farmers have.
And we should say that loan programs are a pillar of agricultural success all across the country, even with farmers who are just enormous, huge farmers, very, very profitable.
Yes, absolutely. And particularly for farmers who are beginning farmers or who are marginalized, either identity or low-income farmers, USDA programs are often the easiest way and the most supported way to get into farming or to receive certain types of grants, or if you're doing, you know, produce farming as opposed to commodity farming. So it's really an essential part of the agriculture economy that has been more or less closed off to families who don't have a clear title to their land.
And I understand that the Farm Bill also, this part of the Farm Bill also increased scholarship and other funding for historically Black land-grant universities.
Yes, that's right. There was another landmark advancement in terms of how historically Black land-grant universities, which are funded in part through USDA, receive their funding and can roll their scholarship funding over year to year, other sorts of technical ways that their finances are handled that had been different for historically Black universities than for predominantly white institutions. And the Congressional Black Caucus really worked significantly on both that issue and the issue of heirs' property to get those provisions passed through in the Farm Bill.
Finally, let's talk about hemp.
Sure.
It made it into the Farm Bill this time around.
Yes. So the Farm Bill removes hemp from the federal government's list of controlled substances, which is not exactly the same as being legalized, but does open up a lot of doors for future cultivation of hemp.
It's interesting to me because historically hemp was considered such a huge American product, a big part of the early countries and the colonies' export economy.
Yes, and that's certainly an argument that folks who have argued for removing hemp from the list of controlled substances have made, that hemp is very versatile and it can be used for all types of agricultural and environmental purposes, can be quite profitable for farmers, but has been sort of lumped in with marijuana and other related plants. Farmers have not been able to legally cultivate it.
Yeah, ever since the fall of tobacco usage has been happening in this country, hemp has often been pointed to as a possible salvation for many farmers.
That's right. And definitely this era of both, you know, hemp destigmatization and marijuana legalization in many states has started a very active conversation about whether and how farmers can break into this industry, especially as crop prices and commodities remain very low and many farmers are struggling with a sort of multi-year economic lull. How can, you know, these new opportunities be taken advantage of? And it is a multi-billion dollar industry, so there does seem to be some opportunity. There's also some concern from agriculture advocates that without sort of proper oversight, this new arrival industry could be quickly rolled up by corporate players or quickly consolidated, and smaller farmers would not end up having the same type of access.
Well, thank you so much. And I guess the next round of the Farm Bill begins almost as soon as this one takes place.
That's right. That's right. Now we can start talking about 5 years from now, Farm Bill. So
that's Leah Douglas. She's a staff reporter and associate editor for the Food and Environment Reporting Network. We've been talking about the Farm Bill that passed Congress last month. With USDA employees out of work due to the shutdown, the implementation of the bill has reportedly been delayed. We'll be keeping an eye out for developments. Now we turn to one of LA's most beloved restaurants. After the break, my conversation with the chefs behind Bestia. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. Bestia was the restaurant that was never supposed to work. That's according to chefs Ori Menashe and Genevieve Gerges. In 2012, the Arts District was quite a different animal. For their chef-driven Italian restaurant, the couple chose a cavernous space at what one Yelp reviewer called the corner of crack and murder. 6 years later, Bestia remains one of the busiest spots in town, where getting a reservation is a coup. It's so great to have the two of you.
Hi, how are you?
It's awesome
good.
Being here.
So I went to Bestia. It was a Monday night, and it was just packed with people.
It's pretty crazy.
You're blessed.
It's yes, we are. Crazy. We are, definitely.
I had dinner there 3 months ago, and I went on a Wednesday night. It was around 10:30 at night, and I walked in, and it was so energetic. While I was sitting there for dinner, all of that stimulation around me just made it so magical, and I never felt that way. I don't know, it's just such a lively place. And, you know, a restaurant that size, if it wouldn't be busy...
Well, it wouldn't be open.
It wouldn't be open.
I'm curious, since you opened Bavel, were you opening Bavel at the same time that you were writing the book, Bestia?
Yes, it was a terrible idea to do that.
But it's interesting in a way because
it was
exhausting.
We were late on the project.
Everybody's late. Everybody's late.
So we were supposed to open Bavel a year before. And then maybe, I don't know what we were thinking.
We don't think.
Yeah, we don't think.
You just do.
Yeah.
But it must have been interesting to, while your mind is engaged in this other road, to look back and solidify the greatest hits of Bestia. Give me an idea of what that felt like.
I don't know exactly what it felt like. It just made sense to me to put all those dishes on the book. You know, the dishes that people ask me, you know, they'll email me for a certain recipe. I get the email for the bone marrow pasta like once a month.
Do you really?
I do. Okay.
And the andouille, a lot.
Yeah, the spreadable andouille and, you know, the bone marrow one. I do send it to people. It wasn't like something that I was hiding from people, but it's very difficult to explain to someone how to do something without all those photos incorporated into it, because you have all the different steps. And when you visualize, it's much easier. You understand the words a lot better. So I don't know. I mean, for me, it wasn't all the greatest hits. All the greatest hits been on the menu since day one, and those are ones that people want to read and try to recreate at home. So
Genevieve, shortly before you opened, Bestia, Ori promised you that if it didn't work out, you were going to move to Israel. Actually, he made it from what you wrote in the book.
No, she promised me.
Oh, yeah.
She promised me we're going back to Israel.
Yeah,
we're going to Israel.
He made me promise him. But that was because he was panicking, because he really just looked around and said, oh, my God, what do we do? And he couldn't sleep, and he was restless, and he was very nervous. And so he said, I hope that you're with me on this, that if this doesn't work, we're moving to Israel because, well, we'll never be able to do anything in L.A. again. Like, we're going to be banished.
We're given a chance.
So I just agreed, but I was, like, just agreeing to calm him down.
It's like you opened in a moment that you reflected and also had a vision of something just enough forward that people were able to, like, hop on the train with you and take a ride.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about how you got to that place. I know that you had a really strong relationship, a mentor, and now strong friendship with Gino Angelini. Was that the place where your love of Italian food really blossomed, or did it happen before that?
No, it happened before. I mean, I had dinner at the Angelini Osteria when I was 23 or 24 for the first time, and I had an incredible meal there. I wanted to meet the chef, and after the meal, he came out from the kitchen, and we had a conversation, and I told him, I never had food like this in my life. I have to work for you. I don't care what I'm going to do. It could be as a dishwasher. I don't care. I just want to work for you. And Gino, obviously, is a great leader, and, you know, he's a great business owner. All his staff that been with him worked for him in the past at other restaurants, so they followed him wherever he went, and so he didn't really have a space in the kitchen. But he told me that he's opening a new place called La Terza, and to get back at him in like 8 months, and we'll see where that goes. I got the job, and my goal was still to work at the Angelini Osteria. So I would work at Angelini from 9 in the morning to 3, and then I would leave and get to La Terza at 3:30 and work till 12, and then go drink all night.
Of course.
That food is so simple, but it's so complex, and that's what I love about it. Like, my pasta cooks at Bestia are, for the volume that they do,
the volume's
it's
extraordinary.
It's pretty crazy. I mean, they have to be really, really good cooks, and the training process is insane because a dish could go so wrong if it's cooked for another 10 seconds. And that's what I love about it. It's a challenge every day. It's about the ingredients, but it's about the technique.
You describe the food at Bestia as Italian, but amplified.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get to that place where you knew how far you could push it? And what was the flavor or mouthfeel you were chasing?
I learned from Gino a lot about umami. And Gino always had these little tricks that he would fold in something into a sauce and it would make it magical. And every time he would do that, he would let me taste it. He would be like, see, Ori, see the difference from what it was 20 minutes ago and what it is right now? That was something that stuck with me for years. And it was something that I'd been really working on to develop all these different layers of flavors that will intensify a dish and make the main ingredient shine even more than what it would if it would just have salt and pepper on it. Now, I don't want to compromise the dish too, so it has to be very well balanced and not overpowering, so figuring all those layers and not compromising is something that I think about as well.
Meat is like at the center of the food at Bestia. What breeds of pigs are coming into the restaurant? And are you bringing in whole animals for all that charcuterie?
Right now, we get two whole pigs from Marinson Farms. These are pigs that are raised in Sonoma. And then they are delivered to Marin County for their last, like, 6 months. And they're non-GMO pigs, red wattles. They have that perfect marbling, perfect amount of meat to fat, just animals that live really well, and you could taste it in the product. So we try to butcher everything in-house, and we do the same thing at Bavel. It's very important to me, and we do the same thing with the produce. I use something, and then she'll use a part of it, and We kind of work together, so there's never any waste.
You can everything. Give it to the bar from the strawberry sumac at Beville.
We
give the syrup to the bar.
We utilize everything from like the citrus peel to the onion roots to the onion skins to...
What do you do with the onion skins?
Onion skins I actually like to char and then make a stock out of it. It tastes really good.
Genevieve, from the very beginning of the process of creating Bestia, did you know your role was going to be in the pastry kitchen?
No. I still can't believe my role is in the pastry kitchen 6 years later. I was supposed to be front of the house, which I'm sure now that everyone knows me well there, that's not a good place for me at all. It was because we've been together for so long and we wanted to have a business together, and I wanted to be there mostly just to support him and be there. And I said, okay, I'm just going to do what I need to do. And the whole plan was maybe to work the front of the house. And when the restaurant got established, I would then maybe move into interior design or more into design, which is kind of where I came from more. But I ended up staying as the pastry chef.
Had you ever staged somewhere? Did you, had you gone to school?
No, I staged after Nancy Silverton told me to stage. And that was it. I staged for 10 whole days at Chez Panisse, which is not a lot to learn pastry, but it was, if I hadn't done it, I would have never had any clue how to set up a kitchen with order sheets and mass production and how to do, you know, things in kind of kits the day before, like to mise out your ingredients, your flours and all those things so that when you have to go to produce, you have as much pre-prepped as possible. So all those things I learned at Chez Panisse, and that was very, very valuable. Nancy said, Genevieve, who are you going to hire that's better than you? And I was like, give me a break. A million people are better than me. But I think she was saying that to encourage me. She said, who are you going to hire? And I stuttered because we hadn't looked yet. She said, nobody. You're going to hire nobody because you're going to be the pastry chef. And she said it with such conviction in her eyes that I was like, I'm going to be the pastry chef. And then, I mean, when Nancy Silverton tells you.
She hypnotized you.
Yeah, she did. I just said, okay, I'll be the pastry chef. And my husband was standing right next to me, and he said, okay, she's going to be the pastry chef. And that was it. And I started testing at home and realizing, wow, this is it. I have to come up with things, not just like a cookie.
She always baked at home, and it was always delicious. But in a restaurant scale, I didn't know what would happen. It could have been a disaster.
There are times it was a disaster.
It was the best thing that happened to the restaurant. I mean, without her pastries in the end, it wouldn't be the same.
You opened Bavel this year, and in fact, it was the last restaurant reviewed by Jonathan Gold. Is this the restaurant you would have opened in Israel? Should Bestia have not worked out?
I don't think so.
No. It's different. It's not normal Middle Eastern food that you would have somewhere. And it's very similar to what we do at Bestia with the flavor layering and doing all of that.
Well, it's so great to have you here. And the book is such a wonderful representation of what the two of you have created. So congratulations.
Thank you so much.
That's husband and wife team, Ori Menashe and Genevieve Gerges. Their restaurant and cookbook are called Bestia. In case you hadn't heard, the LA Times recently named two new food critics. Bill Addison and Patricia Escarcega made their debut for the paper this week. Since many of you will be consulting their wisdom for years to come, I invited them to make an introduction. You've heard Bill on the show before when he was the national reviewer for Eater. So let's start with Patricia. Tell us a bit about yourself. I understand that you were actually born in the Inland Empire.
That's correct. I was born in Riverside, California, from a big citrus family. So my parents met there picking oranges in 1972. Really deep roots in Southern California, especially on my mother's side. My grandfather was a bracero, so anybody's familiar with that program. A lot of movement back and forth between the home state of Jalisco and California. So in a lot of ways, a really typical Southern Californian.
And Bill, remind us where you're from.
I'm from Maryland originally. Though beyond the crabs, I have kicked around so much, I just feel myself basically a citizen of the United States.
Well, especially after the last, how many years were you doing the national reviewing for Eater?
Almost five.
Almost 5 years. And you've come most recently to us from?
I was most recently at the Arizona Republic. I was a dining reporter there. Before that, I was a food critic at Phoenix New Times, Yelp Weekly in Phoenix.
How long have each of you been reviewing restaurants as a discipline?
4 years here, so I very much a newbie compared to Bill.
I've been doing this 17 years now. I don't see myself stopping anytime soon as long as someone's going to pay me to do this.
Have either of you been on the other side working in food service?
I worked in restaurants through a lot of my 20s. I cooked in a bed and breakfast all through my college years in Boston. And then I waited tables. And though I was a friendly soul, I was kind of disorganized and I was better put to use in the kitchen. And I made desserts. I'm uncomfortable calling myself a pastry chef. I think that is too grand a title for what I was up to, but I do really still love to make desserts.
And you, Patricia?
And I don't have much restaurant background experience. Most of my experience has mostly been on the consumption end, which I would say I've done that fanatically since birth.
That's very important in your job. I'm curious to know what your childhoods were like in relationship to food and how your life kind of unfolded so that food and food journalism became at the center.
I feel like I really got into food journalism sideways. That's one of the common questions when you're in this line of work. How did you get into it? Because it is kind of very singular type work. Not everybody gets to do this for a living. I think a lot of my interest came from growing up in a household where we didn't go out to eat. So I grew up on great Mexican home cooking. We didn't really have a budget to eat out growing up. And I became kind of obsessed with restaurants and dining culture as I entered adolescence, just how it's a kind of a modern theater for a lot of us. And it's replaced entertainment for a lot of us going out to eat. So I've really kind of come at it from an outsider's perspective, but I think it's an interesting perspective to have. And I really feel like it's giving me a lot of insights that maybe I wouldn't have if I had, you know, traveled more as a young person or gotten to eat more at, you know, shirt sleeve restaurants, as Jonathan Gold used to call them. So yeah, didn't have much of that growing up.
And what about your education? Were you a journalism or a communication major?
I was an English major. So as we all know, that prepares you to do not much in life. but at the same time, it prepares you to do everything. So I had a solid liberal arts background. I went to graduate school and I studied creative writing. So I have an MFA in creative writing. And I also have a master's in library science. So I like to call myself a failed amateur librarian, which is actually really useful for any line of work. You learn, you know, the basics of research, which comes in handy in journalism. It really dovetails beautifully with journalism.
If Patricia came at this indirectly, I literally came at it head on. When I was approaching 30, I had gone to school for singing and acting, and I told myself when I was 16 years old and really into those things, particularly the singing, if I hadn't broken in by then, that I would find a new dream for myself. And I had not broken in, and I thought about what I spent all my time thinking about, and it was food and restaurants and cooking. And I had always really loved writing. I've studied with a woman who's become a very good friend, Natalie Goldberg, who wrote a book called Writing Down the Bones. And I got my break at the Alt Weekly in Atlanta and took it from there in 2002. I was lucky. My parents had the means to take my brother and I out to nice meals occasionally, and we were four incredibly different personalities, still are. So we got along best at the dining table at a nice meal. We clicked in ways that we didn't otherwise click in real life, and we respected each other's predilections and nurtured each other's kind of characters at the dining table. If my brother liked his gamey meat and my father was like the veal Oscar guy and my mother's fish better come out hot or it's going back to the kitchen, my parents would play a game with me where they would cover the menu prices and ask me which dish was the most expensive, and I was very good at that game.
Very interesting. So, Bill, I'm sure you're really happy to get to get off the road and dig into one scene.
Unspeakably happy. It was an incredible education. I will carry those Eater years with me for the rest of my life. I'll probably write a book about it at some point. but I was really exhausted by the end and really unrooted, you know, personally. Not even so much professionally. I could keep doing that, really. You know, I have a deep wanderlust, but I'm so excited to call Los Angeles home. It's the whole world is here. I don't need to go anywhere.
It's interesting. I mean, over the last few years that we've had the opportunity to talk while you've been at Eater, I've watched you fall in love with Los Angeles.
Yes, you have. So, yeah, I feel like every year I'd come back and feel giddier and giddier about getting to talk to you about Los Angeles.
And for you, Patricia, it's like coming home.
Yeah, it's been really wonderful. It really does feel like a homecoming. I mean, when you grow up in the Inland Empire, I feel like you get a bit of a sense of being outside looking in. And I think a lot of the movement is trying to move westward. But it's an interesting dynamic that you have between the Inland Empire and LA County and Orange County. And I'm really interested in how those different communities interplay and kind of the cultural forces at work and how they all kind of develop similarly and yet different. And they've all really contributed to the kind of mythology of Southern California. So I'm really interested in exploring that and just so excited to be here and really dig into that.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I think about the communities that you were covering before, there's so many similarities. It's just maybe even bigger here.
Yeah, I do draw a lot of parallels. I've covered a lot of cities that are kind of built out of transplants, so people from everywhere, and how they come together and how they kind of rub up against each other and how that's filtered through food culture and what comes out of those different collaborations and different relationships and just how communities evolve together. So I think if you're interested in that kind of, you know, exploring food through that cultural lens, it really feels like Los Angeles is the place to be.
So let's talk about the job. The world's changing so rapidly. What do you think the role of the restaurant critic should be? Or maybe how do you perceive your role, each of you, as a critic?
I think it's such a big role, and you can go in so many directions. For me personally, I'm very interested in exploring it. I know it's been said to death, but it's so true, exploring just the culture of food, especially, again, being in California, being in Southern California, where it's one of the most diverse places, you know, in the United States, and just being able to interpret those kind of cultures through food. I feel like there's a lot to be said there. There's so much food journalism that is superficial, and not trying to put anybody else's work down, but so much food journalism just kind of scratches the surface. So it feels like the critic's role, especially in the kind of landscape we're in right now in journalism, where those kind of roles are diminishing, there's so many few critics roles left in the country. It really feels like we should make the best of it and really tackle everything we can, from immigration, politics, you know, food production, food systems, but also not forget the traditional service journalism aspect of food criticism, which I think is important. So I really want to take kind of a holistic view and try to, as much as I can, do it all.
I do also believe, just because restaurant criticism is disappearing in the city and in America, that service journalism does play a really crucial role in what we do. And it's almost funny to come back full circle to that, because there's so much conversation about the wide world of food and how food is culture and cultural criticism should be a part of what we do. I want to give readers a rich, illuminating, contextual read, but I also want them to be able to read a piece of criticism and tell whether or not I enjoyed a restaurant and whether they think they too might enjoy going to this restaurant or not.
That's what it's about in the end.
I really believe that. Yeah.
So let's talk about the elephant in the room. Race, class, and gender.
I don't think that's even an elephant anymore. I think it is like the whole Noah's Ark sitting in here.
So it's the first time the Times has hired two critics. And the first woman, Latina, Bill, is here too, the white man.
Yes,
I
am.
The representative, which I think, given the number of years you've been doing it, is inevitable. I think that there's a place for honoring depth of experience. And unfortunately, there wasn't a lot of opportunity for people of more diverse backgrounds to acquire that kind of experience.
Exactly. Yes. I think part of the reason that they hired me is because I not only had a perspective, an insider's, outsider's perspective of Los Angeles, because I'd spent so much time here falling in love with the city, culinarily and otherwise, but I bring, you know, my knowledge of the whole country and the whole state to our work here. And that's going to play a part in how we cover things. Of course, Los Angeles is what we focus on, but there'll be other stuff too.
I understand that both of you are embracing anonymity.
That's right.
Is this something that was important to the two of you, or was it something that was imposed on you by the paper?
The paper would, I think, almost have been happier if we had not chosen anonymity. They're fine with whatever direction we go, but, you know, events, things like the month-long food bowl, LA Food Bowl in May, are critical to part of how the Times presents food. And restaurants and dining out. For me, you have a really hard time finding a picture of me on the internet. I know that there's at least one picture of me floating around right now. I know where it comes from. I'm not happy about it. I know which PR person put it out in the world. But I don't love that feeling when you walk into a restaurant and there's this ripple of tension suddenly around you, this kind of panic. Then, you know, you feel the panic in the restaurant, then you feel anxious throughout the meal. I just want to have the same experience that any person who loves food going into a restaurant will have.
Have you always been anonymous, Patricia?
I have always been anonymous. And just to kind of follow up on what Bill said, it just really feels to me that we live in a time where there's been a blurring of the line between public relations and journalism, where it really feels like at least trying to be anonymous is pledging allegiance to the journalism side of that. So I really want any reader to know that, you know, this is our full-time job. We take it very seriously. We're not, you know, trying to move between those two worlds. I feel there should be a firewall between those two worlds. And I think it makes the work better and it makes readers more confident in, you know, what you produce.
Amen.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, it's obviously bittersweet for us here, but I'm so happy to welcome the two of you, and I look forward to many conversations.
Thanks, Evan.
Thanks, Evan.
I've been speaking with Bill Addison and Patricia Escarcega, the LA Times new food critics. You can read their debut reviews in today's print edition of the LA Times or at latimes.com. Coming up, a visit to a new Japanese fried chicken spot that just made its own debut. My conversation with Zach Brooks after the break. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. It's true that we Angelenos love our grain bowls, juice bars, and avocado toast. Not to be overlooked, however, is our city's obsession with fried chicken and its endless variations. Though the hot chicken craze shows little sign of slowing, there's another bird in town worth knowing about. My friend Zach Brooks and I recently checked out a restaurant called Pico Nico by Chef Kuniko Yagi. It opened last month at The Row in downtown LA. Hello, Zach.
Hi, Evan.
So fried chicken. I mean, fried chicken has always been a beloved American food. It just seems like, at least here in Los Angeles, the number of fried chicken places are becoming exponential.
Yeah, I mean, it's a thing.
It's a thing. And now it's a thing that we can divide up into three categories, I guess. Standard American fried chicken.
All right. I'm with you so far.
Nashville hot chicken. And then Japanese fried chicken, which has always had a place here in Los Angeles.
Sure, like you mean karaage.
Yeah, karaage is the Japanese tradition of frying chicken. Usually it's boneless chicken. Often it's been marinated in something umami-esque. Soy sauce, garlic, ginger sometimes. And then it is dusted with potato starch, which gives it a different kind of crisp and crunch than American fried chicken, which is usually dredged in flour.
Yeah, it's the delicious balls of fried chicken that you find it. You know, you can get it as add-ons at some ramen places, or there are places that specialize just in that. It's pretty delicious.
Perhaps we should talk a bit about Kuniko's background. She's a Top Chef alum, but she's been working in LA for a long time. She's a self-taught chef who was basically kind of culinarily adopted by Chef David Myers and came in to start learning to cook at Sona, and then ended up staying through Komsa, and then the two of them went on to create Hinoki and the Bird. But Bikuniko, which is a play on both Kuniko's name and the Japanese word for picnic, which is pikuniku.
Pikuniko is a casual restaurant based on a picnic food that you can take it outside to eat, like lunch and dinner. Main menu is Japanese fried chicken, and this is a memory with my grandma. Grandma used to take me to a department store called Takashimaya in Japan, like every weekend. And my favorite thing to buy from Takashimaya's department store was the fried chicken. And so this is to my grandma. Thank you. Thank you to her.
So let's talk about the chicken. What kind of combinations did you have?
So you can get thigh, which is a boneless thigh, or a piece of a boneless thigh. They have fingers, right?
Tenders,
right. And then, which is, I think, the white meat, right? So
yes.
If you want dark meat, you get thigh. If you want white meat, you get the tenders. And then they have bone-in wings. But the best part is they have a combo where you get a little of each. So you can get the combo that gives you one thigh, two little tenders, and a wing, which is
perfect.
The obvious order, even though I guess if push came to shove, thigh is probably the best one, right?
I normally would never order either white meat or a finger or a tender. But I have to say that was some of the most delicious white meat chicken I've had in quite a long time. It was just perfect. So juicy. So let's talk about the texture of this chicken. It was crisp more than craggy.
It doesn't have a ton of batter.
Let's hear a little more from Kuniko about that.
My fried chicken is not just traditional Japanese fried chicken, but I made a hybrid between Southern-style American fried chicken and Japanese chicken. I like American fried chicken being really crispy on the outside crust. Japanese fried chicken is not always really crispy, so I made that to be crispy crust. But I love the marinade, the base of the Japanese fried chicken. Japanese don't necessarily use buttermilk and stuff, but we use soy sauce and ginger and garlic and sake. And we tend to use potato starch for crust, but potato starch is not a thick bind or thick crust that you can crunch to bite into. So I added organic brown rice flour to it.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely crunchy. I think, listen, in the end, you hear fried chicken, you're like, oh, I have to have fried chicken. You go expecting this to be like a Hal and Ray's situation, right? You're going to be very disappointed. I mean, this is beautifully crafted fried chicken. It's the kind of fried chicken I feel like you could eat once a week and not feel bad about it.
Oh, totally. It's much more delicate.
We should also mention a big thing, that it's gluten-free.
Yeah, because it's potato starch that she uses to dredge the chicken. It's gluten-free. Yeah, she's using actually sourced pasture-raised chicken. So there's a lot to be said for that. And the dipping sauces are another way in which this experience is quite different because they're not barbecue. There is one that has a bit of spice, but it's not overwhelming. The parsley sesame one, right?
Yeah.
The one that was kind of Japanese version of chimichurri, I felt like.
I think that's my favorite one.
I have to say, I loved both the lemon aioli and the daikon ponzu oroshi.
Yeah, so you have you get your choice of combo, and then you can choose either these delicious fingerling potatoes that are dusted with like a seaweed salt or the rice ball. But truthfully, it's best to go with a group of people and just order everything. The salads to me are really the thing that set this place apart. It's the kind of thing that I crave, that I want to go back and eat again. So like, for example, the potato salad.
So you say potato salad, and even in a Japanese context, what I think of is a potato, lots of mayonnaise, kind of something in between cut up and smashed with a bit of a sesame taste and some broccoli thrown in there.
And this is kind of that,
but
she uses Japanese sweet potatoes.
Which makes it completely different.
It makes it something that I actually like because I'm not a huge potato salad fan.
It's so delicious.
And it's so good. It's the best. It's my favorite potato salad I've ever eaten. And then she has a salad made of pickles, like a pickle salad, basically, that's also delicious, that I think had watermelon radish and
cucumbers, wakame. Beautiful.
Yes.
That's the super crunchy one.
Yep.
And then there's a slaw, which is, you know, your cabbage, your kale, your red onion, but with a really nice sesame vinaigrette.
And it's delicious. And to me, I could eat a big bowl of that slaw and a couple pieces of fried chicken on top, and that would be a perfect lunch.
And then the one thing I didn't get is the chicken egg drop soup, which if you go online now sort of has its own thread.
It is really good.
Yeah, and I guess some people had gone to Kuniko and said, why don't you turn this into a porridge by adding a little more rice? And she did that. So apparently now there's a secret menu item.
Mm.
Did you try the sandwich? I didn't get to the sandwich.
Yeah, the sandwich is, I guess what makes her sandwich different is that she serves it on this like golden bun.
It's a turmeric bun, and I have to give Kuniko a shout out because she was the first person in LA to make charcoal buns.
Oh, right, for the lobster roll at Hinoki and the Bird.
Exactly. So she has a history of playing with dough.
It is a good fried chicken sandwich, but it's not the thing that I'm going to think of when I think of this
place.
Oh,
yeah, no, I'm definitely going to get a basket.
And we should also say they have a rice bowl with grilled chicken if you're, you know, into those sort of healthy things. So there are reasons for everybody to enjoy this place. This is Los Angeles, after all.
I've been talking with Smorgasburg LA General Manager Zach Brooks about Pico Nico by Chef Kuniko Yagi. You can try her signature karaage at the Row in downtown Los Angeles. Before we go, I wanted to mention LA's premier restaurant week, Dine LA. The winter program kicked off this week, and it's the biggest ever, with well over 400 restaurants to choose from. Dine LA runs through January 25th, so make your reservations now. It's a perfect time to try out some new spots. For a full list of participating restaurants, visit dinela.com. That's it for our show this week. If you missed any of it, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, and as always, leave us a review if you like the show. My thanks to the Good Food team, Nick Leal, Lero Garcia, Joel Stein, Joseph Stone, and Ronnie Mickelson. Special thanks to Abby Swanson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.